Oh, that gives me nostalgia. That gives me nostalgia. The Canon Films logo. You must remember the Canon Films.
I'm so old.
Well, we had a Canon cinema.
There's kids that are literally like, the Netflix logo will come on and they're like, oh yeah, that, do you remember when Netflix first came out? We're like talking about logos that came out 30 years ago.
Canon, yeah. We had Canon cinemas in Portsmouth. Yeah, we had one in Cosham, in Portsmouth, where we are.
Long time
ago. We had one
ago.
In Commercial Road.
Long time ago.
That brings back some memory. Don't sing any more of that. We can't afford it. Yeah, that brings back some memories. That does the old down, 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 down. There you go. I did it on the pod this time. I always do it pre-cue, and then in post, I lose it and put the actual logo in, and Paul always says to me, you should have left in you singing it. It was much funnier. Anywho, welcome to We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod. We're back on track with weekly. I think we've both done about 57 interviews each.
I have no idea what day it is, what time it is, what's come out in the last month. I have no idea.
We were playing like interview top trumps earlier because we've easily cleared about 25 each, I think. They'll all come out in due course, of course.
It's been a busy time.
Something like that. But yeah, I think we've moved some stuff around so we can bring this to you every week. So fingers crossed.
We are trying. We're absolutely trying.
That's our hope. That's what we want to do. We hope you're enjoying it so far. Thank you so much to everyone for your lovely, lovely feedback. I'm John Brown.
I'm Paul Marsh.
And you are listening to the film podcast that is mostly populated by moaning middle-aged men.
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much, yeah.
Well, he moans.
I moan a lot.
I like to...
You like to try and be positive. Do you know what the irony of it is?
I try and be positive.
So the irony of it is, for my radio show on Express FM, which is weekdays at 10 a.m.
Yeah, get that in there.
Like, I'm all about positivity. All of my features about being positive and everything else like that. You put a film in front of me, I just want to, tear it to shreds.
It's like...
Isn't that weird?
Like a red rat
Isn't
to
that
a
weird?
Bull when yeah. someone gives you like, especially like a legacy sequel or
something.
We got one of those later.
I know, I'm going to get angry already.
We're going to talk about that later. But yes, welcome. We'll talk all about movies and a little bit of TV as well, because we've been getting, especially you, we've been getting a lot more into television lately. And of course, that's an ever rising thing. If we can find the time, we may even turn that into a separate podcast. But that's something. Yeah, I mean, thank you so much to everyone, particularly Sky and ITVX here in the UK, because they've been very supportive of us. So you will hear more. We've got an ITVX interview in this show, which we'll talk about in a minute. So there is some TV littered in there as well, mainly among the streaming section. But every now and then, we like to dip our toe in the pond that is TV.
Well, there's so much great TV around. The quality of television shows has gone through the roof, hasn't it?
It has. But if you have any feedback for us, we've got a lovely gift. I've just seen that come through, a lovely little gift from Simon Bruce, which you'll hear in this pod, because by the time I get it back to the studio, it'll be in. Thank you for that, Simon Bruce. We'll get to that a bit later in the show.
The magic of technology.
The magic of technology, like me not singing logos and just pasting them in instead. If you want to give us your feedback, though, good, bad or otherwise, if it's negative, we will take it on faith. If it's good, of course, we'll read it all out. And if it's just nasty, then we'll read it out to laugh at you. At John Brown TV, that's at J-O-N Brown TV for me on all socials. Paul?
I'm on all socials as at Paul Swampy Marsh.
And you can follow the pod at Need a Bigger Pod. And if you want to listen to him every morning, weekdays, 10 a.m. at Express FM to get more details there. Also, composer series is there if you want to hear more one-to-ones with myself, Sean Wilson, and various composers of film, TV and video games. That's every Sunday night at 6, also at Express FM. There we go. Right, down to business. What's coming up on the show, Paul?
Oh, we have got so much for you. So we've got all the usual. We've got some news. We've got some trailers we're going to look at. We're going to review some films that have been at the cinema. We're going to look at some streaming as well, because like we're talking about, streaming is getting huge. Why do I say it's getting huge?
Oh,
like it happened overnight.
Huge, yeah,
streaming,
I mean,
is huge,
especially during the pandemic.
Have you noticed in the last 2 weeks, streaming got huge?
Yeah,
I don't think anybody watched it before.
it's like bless him. It's like he's just discovered streaming services. God love him.
We of course have our tip top five. Are we going to say what it's about now? Or save it for later.
Yeah, we could do that. It's on the internet already.
That's very true. Of course, yes, it is a tip top five of dogs.
Dogs. Movies with dogs. Movies about dogs. Anything to do with dogs. We're celebrating dogs this week.
Paw Patrol.
Yeah, Paw Patrol is in cinemas. this weekend. It's been doing great business on previews, actually. So, yeah, that'll be out just in time for half term here in the UK. We have a half term. And, yeah, I'm sure that's going to be very popular with kids and pups alike.
Yes. But we have got three fantastic interviews this week.
We have indeed. They're all mine. That was luck of the draw.
Mine. All mine.
I think it was timing. Sorry about that. I feel really bad because I feel like, because Paul's done some great interviews, but you will hear them in due course because, of course, we kind of sort of move them around and then hold them till the week something comes out and then it's kind of more relevant. So Paul has got some amazing interviews to come, just not on this episode. Sorry about that, mate.
No, that's right. I know where I'm not wanted.
I literally just said to you as we came to the studio, I bet next week they'll all be yours, just it in balance. But anyway, yes, we have in cinemas, the Old Oak is still playing, of course, Ken Loach's potentially final film, I think they were saying. Paul Laverty, who is Ken's long-term writing partner, will be on the show with us. And also, the star of the film is Dave Taylor.
Dave Turner,
there we go.
Very good. He's very, very good in the film. Very good.
It's the podcast that gets people's names wrong. I was the one that spoke to him as well. That's
awful. The thing is, what you could have done is you could have literally cut that if you hadn't have made a big deal of it like we've just done. You possibly could have cut that so nobody would have ever known. But we've done this big whole 30-second thing about it now, so you have to leave it in.
Paul Laverty and Dave Turner, the star of The Old Oak, will be on the show. I spoke to them, had a lovely conversation with them about very, very good film, which you enjoyed, actually.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And you did, yeah. So that is on, very good film. Old Oak, of course, being in cinemas now, from Ken Loach. Also in streaming, I say streaming, it's more like TV, but on ITVX, we've had a great response to the show Payback, which, of course, is from Jed Mercurio. I will speak to, or have been speaking to, and have spoken to, and had a really wonderful conversation, actually, with Morven Christie, who is the star of the show. She was amazing. She's on this podcast as well. And Kevin Schultz, director of the film Girl Gone Bad, will be on the show as well. That's debuted on Prime Video worldwide. I'll be talking to him a little bit later on. All right. Down to business.
So, looking at the news, Angelina Jolie has been cast as opera singer Maria Callas in Pablo Larraín's new film.
Ooh, Pablo Larraín makes great movies.
Are you a big fan of Maria Callas?
I am of Pablo Larraín and of Angelina Jolie. So.
Well, yes, okay, by default, I guess, you know, you're probably going to end up looking forward to that one because, let's face it, it's not very often that those two do anything that's not worth watching.
Exactly that. Yeah, for sure. Pablo Larraín's an amazing director. Amazing storyteller. So yeah, this will be interesting. And I'll learn something because I don't know anything about this artist. So the
one thing that has come up about this, of course, is the fact that it's been revealed that this has been going on, but the fact that obviously they've been shooting it while the strike has been going on, which is...
Revelation. Yes. Plot twist.
So I don't know enough about this, but it's something to do with the fact that it's an independent film and it has an interim agreement with SAG.
Okay.
Allowing them to kind of get ready for when things are going to be ready to go. And they're shooting in Paris, Greece, Budapest and Milan.
Okay, I don't really know too much about that. I just know that there were certain arrangements where it was allowed.
Yeah.
It's all very, very confusing. I mean, was this the writers or the actors or both?
Actors, I think.
Yeah, because the actors, yeah. Is that still going on?
Yes.
I think it is. Yeah,
yes.
Very much so. Interesting.
Yeah, so I guess more, I've absolutely no doubt whatsoever there will be more news revealed once they start shooting and more details will come out, etc. But again, it's all very sort of murky waters at the moment with the strikes, isn't it?
I hope it's over before that happens.
I really do.
People want to get back to work, and rightly so, and as they should, but these agreements need to be finalised, a balance, a chord must be struck that works for everybody.
I'm absolutely positive that there's no way Angelina Jolie would be doing anything that wasn't agreed and allowed, you know.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
The other thing that has kind of come out right now, which I think a lot of people are very excited about, is it looks as though we're getting Heat 2.
Oh, excellent. Well, Michael Mann wrote the book, didn't he?
Mm.
He wrote the book and that was very, very popular. And I kind of hoped...
I don't think it was originally planned to be a movie ever. Well, I know he wrote the book and he released the book and everything else like that, but I don't think the plan was to make it into a movie, but it has such a great response.
I hoped that would be his plan, and then to reveal today that Michael Mann's next film is going to be Heat 2 fills my heart with joy, but at the same time, first one's pretty untouchable.
I guess it depends where it goes. Now, again, we know nothing for sure, but there's a rumour of Adam Driver being cast, who is, let's face it, phenomenal. Question is, I mean, anybody else from the original?
I mean, we'll see.
I don't know.
Time will tell. I haven't read the book. I think we should read the book.
Well, yeah, okay. That would probably be a good point, wouldn't it? I guess the book would tell us whether, you know.
If you are a publisher of the book, email us, michaelmarshproductions@gmail.com. We'll give you our address.
That was very official, wasn't it?
Send to. Well, yes. I mean, let's see where it goes. Anyone that's read the book, let us know. At Need a Bigger Pod. Where do you think the movie should go? I'd be interested. It is interesting. I really can't talk today. What's going on? I talk for a living. This is awful. Sleep is always good, John. Always good. Always. Anyway, yes.
I love it when you struggle and I just sit in silence.
Coffee sponsorships are all welcome. Also, let us know. MichaelMarshProductions@gmail.com. Yes, I'm looking forward to Heat 2. I want to see what happens. I mean, Michael Mann is an excellent filmmaker. I think whatever happens, it's not going to be awful.
So, there have been a few films come out recently that have had, you know, their sequel come out after 20 years, 30 years, whatever it is. And we've said that would they bring these films back? Let's take Indiana Jones, for example. We said that would Harrison Ford come back for another Indiana Jones if it wasn't a 5 out of 5, smash it out the park, phenomenal film? And we all said, no, he wouldn't. There's no way that he would come back to ruin the legacy by making another average film.
But...
and he did.
But he believed it was a 5 out of 5.
Well, I guess so.
When he made the movie, he was visibly moved.
Yeah, I guess
by the finished cut.
So, I just think... oh, I don't know.
Listen,
I don't
one know. Man's I don't zero know. Star is another man's five.
Yeah, I know, I know. I just think there's a lot of time passed between... Unless it focuses on like an entirely new gang, I don't know.
I say man in the context of Harrison Ford believing he made a 5-star movie, which I genuinely believe that he does believe that, as he should. But, of course, any person's 0-star movie can be any other person's 5-star movie.
Yeah, of course.
It's everything,
It's all subjective.
It's all subjective. Objective, like, it's in the eye of the beholder. There are things that I absolutely adore that when I tell you that I adore them, you give me that look that you're giving me now. You look like I need like some sort of clinical support. And there are films that, quite frankly, you've got very good taste in films. I will give you that.
Thank you.
That's why we're doing this together, because you do have very good taste in films. But every now and again, you'll throw one out there, and I'll be like,
I think nostalgia has a lot to do with that,
the
doesn't it?
Difference is, I will go, fair enough. Everyone's got their thing.
I saw a debate online the other day talking about... what's it called? What's the vampire hunter?
Blade?
No. Hugh Jackman.
Oh, Van Helsing.
Van Helsing. And there was a load of people saying, oh, you know, it gets a bad rep, but it's a really great film. And there was all these people that were all a similar age kind of going, oh, I love it, it's fantastic. It's not. It's so bad. But nostalgia, I think, skews people's vision. I think if you watch something when you're 13, 14 years old, and forever that film is part of you because that was when you were growing up and you grow into films, and you saw something and you loved it at the time, and you always watch it through nostalgia. I mean, you like some of the Turtles films.
That's a terrible example.
You look so disappointed that I linked you with that.
No, but the OG one that Jim Henson was involved with in 1990, literally anyone will tell you that is benchmark, because that is essentially is Golden Harvest, which is obviously was famous for releasing Bruce Lee movies. That is a classic martial arts movie that just so happens to have turtles in it. That's on a very different level to the films that followed it, which were quite awful. Like, literally every Turtles movie that followed it was quite terrible, apart from two animated ones. The most recent animated one and the animated one they did, like, 10, 15 years ago. But live-action Turtles films are, by and large, awful. Apart from that first one, because it was darker, it was much more adult. It wasn't for adults, but it was dark enough to be. It was in that time around Tim Burton's Batman, and so, you know, comic book movies were quite edgy and dark. I think it got that right. But also, Jim Henson, man. Jim Henson. Look,
All I'm saying is it sort of sits
on its own pedestal. But a lot of people will tell you that that's not a film you look at through nostalgic lenses. Also, I periodically, as you well know, go back through 80s, 90s, and even 70s stuff just to make sure I'm not looking at something with a nostalgic lens. And for research reasons, I watched the 1990 Turtles movie at least 3 times in the last 12 months, and it still stands up as good as it was when it first came out.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. And you got very defensive about it.
I have a lot of people that will back me on that. Because it's a terrible example. It's a terrible example. That's not an example. Like, we're essentially talking about guilty pleasures, aren't we, right?
Yes.
That's
okay,
not an example of a guilty pleasure. Okay. That's like a benchmark movie. A guilty pleasure would be something like Van Helsing.
Which is awful.
Which, well, it is. I completely concur. But it's
the first 10 minutes of Van Helsing are fantastic. When it's in black and white, the first 10 minutes are brilliant, and after that, it's just awful.
It's someone else's five-star movie, right? Bram Stoker, going back to vampires, Bram Stoker's Dracula, right? Hallmark picture, but a lot of people think it's the worst Dracula movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just, it's all
opinion. Who are these
people? Opinion.
Bring them
but
to my table.
But you need, there are different examples, right? Turtles is kind of benchmark. That's like saying The Godfather's terrible.
That is so far from being wrong. You could not be more wrong.
Yeah, but
are you actually comparing The Godfather to the 1990 Teenage Turtles?
No, I'm comparing.
You're saying that.
I'm comparing the setup, because you're essentially saying the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is awful.
I think it is. I don't think it's a good film. I don't think Turtles
but
is
you
a
don't,
good film.
Yeah, but counterpoint, you don't like anything comic book related.
Some things I do, some things I don't.
When we started this podcast, I thought I was literally going to have to take you to a therapist every time Marvel was mentioned. Literally.
But there's two things I don't like about Marvel movies. One is the main thing. Like, for example, I love Iron Man and Iron Man 2, etc. I think they're great. And there's the odd one in the 4,000 other films that they release that I like as well. Yeah. My main and huge problem with Marvel films is the fact that if you haven't seen the previous 398,000 of them,
you can't enjoy
this one.
Shang-Chi
was great.
Yeah.
Blue Beetle was great.
Yeah, that was DC.
I know, but comic book movies I'm getting at.
Yeah.
So if it's a standalone film, I love it. But what I don't like is if I have to have seen... How many films have you said to me, right, in the last year when I've gone, oh, I'll go and watch that, and you've gone, no. Why? Because you haven't seen, and you will literally list other movies.
Yeah, no, this happened... For clarification, this happened once with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. I said, do you need to see it? And you went, I've seen the first one. You did that thing, and I said, right, okay. I'd seen it like 3 times before it even came out, and I basically explained to you, you're probably going to need to do this, 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 and this for it to make any sense to you. And you just went, well, I won't bother then.
Because I didn't have time to watch 4 films. I barely got time to watch one film, let alone four.
Because my concern was, you'd go off, be completely confused by it, come back and go, oh, that was about 2 stars. So it was like...
That does not sound like me at all.
I have to argue Guardian's case, because I have to sort of sit there and go, okay, if you're going to throw this movie under the bus, I need to make sure you've given it as fair a shot as humanly possible.
That does not sound like something I would do at all.
No, because I say, God, that's why you're laughing, because you know I'm right. But no, to go back to your original point.
Right, we've got way off the beaten track here.
Turtles is one of those films, this is where all the fun stuff happens. Turtles is one of those films that the singular original Turtles is one of those films that you put up on a shelf.
And leave it there.
That pretty much everyone says, oh yeah, that was cool. Right, The Godfather is on a different tier, right?
It's God tier.
Scarface, all that. What I'm saying is, there are movies that generally, by and large, everybody agrees are great. Movies like Godfather and Star Wars are iconic and they're legendary and they're like top tier, God tier. They're movies that are pretty much untouchable, right? But there are some movies that generally everyone agrees. Do you know what? That's a great movie. There are a few people that don't agree. Like, you're in the minority on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It took you some time, but you came around to it.
We've been through this before, but basically, long story short, it just wasn't what I was expecting.
But my point is, there are movies that are questionable or by and large are seen or known or widely revered as terrible, But someone somewhere out there
will love it.
Gives Van Helsing a 5-star rating, right? There has been some absolute hot garbage that's been out since we've been doing this. But to someone, that movie is a 5-star movie. And my point is, you don't like Turtles. You think it's garbage.
I don't think it's garbage. I don't think it's good.
I like it. The point I'm trying to ultimately come to before we move on to the next thing is that's okay. It's okay that you think it's garbage.
I know.
And that's what makes this fun. It's what makes it interesting. And that's why film discussion is always interesting, as long as it's respectful. And yes, I was very defensive about Turtles because it's good. And I saw it recently enough to know it stands out. If I hadn't seen it since 1990, I'd probably sit here going, do you know what? I'm going to be quiet because I haven't seen it for a long time. And I'm going to argue with him now, go back home later and
regret
watch
everything
it,
I said.
And then watch it back and go, oh my God, he's right. This is awful. But no, I had watched it very recently. So no, it still stands up. And considering what I mean, very little to no CGI and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You're dealing with guys in those huge suits having to pull off martial arts and stuff. So I've got to give it way more credit. But yeah, I mean, Turtles versus Godfather. Obviously, Godfather's going to win that.
Now, there's a movie, by the way. That could be a new... Never mind Godzilla versus Kong. Turtles versus Godfather.
Turtles versus the...
Yes, please,
Corleones.
I'll take that one.
Yeah.
Bring Marlon Brando back.
What a film. No, we can't do that.
CGI, baby.
No, we're not doing that. We're not getting into AI. We've gone way off track.
I was just about to say that. Let's move on because this is turning into a Scorsese 3.5-hour podcast.
Godfather wins that battle. Since you decided to make it about two movies against each other, I'm going to say Godfather will always win any battle.
I'd love to debate somebody that thinks otherwise. Fantastic.
That Turtles is better than Godfather. I bet someone's out there.
There
that
are
thinks Turtles.
100% there will
if you're
be,
listening 100%. And you think,
don't do it, don't do it,
Turtles
don't do it.
Is better.
I'm trying to stay
Godfather.
So calm on social media. Don't come at me
at
saying
needs a bigger pod. If you are out there, you're listening, and you do actually think that you like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1990, the original, more than the Godfather, let us know. I am your people. I'm not saying it is. Personally, I think The Godfather is one of the greatest films ever made, and it's still better than Turtles. But someone out there genuinely thinks Turtles is better than Godfather. So I want to hear from that person. I might even find you a prize. But anyway, at Need a Bigger Pod, let's get back around to the last bit of new. Where did we get to?
I don't know.
I'm just
thinking to myself, brilliant. I've got to come off social media for a few days. Fantastic. Right. Where were we? Baz Luhrmann has got a new series called Far Away Downs, which is debuted at South by Southwest in Sydney.
Ooh.
And it is a kind of a continuation from Australia.
Yeah, see, Australia. I really liked Australia.
Do you know what? I don't think I've seen it.
You can have one of my copies because I found out the other day I've got about three copies
of
it.
Okay,
and I didn't even realise.
Because it looks like something that I would love.
It's really, really. It's a sweeping romantic epic, to be fair. But Baz Luhrmann's very good at those.
Yes.
I really, really liked it. I think at the time I gave it a 4. See, there we go. A movie that essentially, I don't know, that I think even in some of those news pieces they're saying that the original bombed for him and it wasn't his most well-reviewed or most
this
successful picture.
This would have came after Romeo and Juliet?
Yes, of course. This was like 2000s. But I really liked it. So there we go. Here's another case in point, right? I'm probably on an island here in saying that I really like Australia, whereas lots of people are probably shouting at their devices now going, boo, it's awful. I'm like, no, it's actually, I think, as a sweeping romantic epic, it was really good. I mean, it's cheese factor 10, but
oh,
it's
is it really?
Really
right,
oh, yeah,
okay.
But it's superb. I love the way it's shot. It's beautifully made. Beautifully made. But anyway, yes, that's getting a 6-part series. Is it Amazon Prime is going to, I think? I don't know what
Hulu.
That noise was, but I'm...
Hulu and Disney Plus.
Oh, it'll be Disney Plus, yes, of course it will.
So it is starring Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman.
There we go. Okay,
and
perfect.
Brian Brown and Brandon Walters, Ben Mendelsohn and...
A 6-part... A sequel, essentially,
yes,
to the Australian
movie.
Yeah, I'm into that. Give us more, Disney Plus. Thank you very much.
And expanding on the Australia universe.
All right. That's coming soon. More news on that later. Trailer time.
So, all of these trailers, actually, were kind of right up my alley. It feels like you chose them for me, which I have to say thank you.
Okay.
Oh, before we get to these trailers, can we talk about the trailer for Thanksgiving?
Oh, yeah, because it...
So I went on a rant in our previous episode, didn't I? At the trailer for Thanksgiving, which the first trailer for Thanksgiving, it's just awful. It's terrible. I don't know who cut it together, but it's terrible. They've released a second trailer, and it's fantastic.
It
literally encompasses what the original trailer in Grindhouse was all about. It's schlocky, it's cheesy, it's bad, but it's brilliant bad.
Like this podcast.
No, this podcast is it's just bad. But whoever,
I've never seen a man stand up and applaud a trailer I watched him watch Thanksgiving. I was sat next to him when it happened, and I actually thought he was going to weep with joy.
So, we're not going to talk about it, but I just want to say, whoever cut that second trailer, thank you very much. Right, so looking at trailers, we are looking at It's a Wonderful Knife, which is not a million miles away, of course, from Thanksgiving. So, yeah, It's a Wonderful Knife, which is a take on, of course, It's a Wonderful Life. It throws the horror shade in there, and it's not a million miles away from Scream. In the fact, obviously, with the Scream, you have the big black outfit, and in It's a Wonderful Knife, it's a big white outfit. So it focuses basically on, like I say, It's a Wonderful Life, which features George, and how one day when he's at his absolute lowest, he says, I wish that I was never even born. The world would be a much better place without me. And that's exactly what happens in this film. Jane Widdop, that's the name I was looking for, Jane Widdop. She is at her... So, basically, how much can I give? It's in the trailer, so I suppose I can talk about this.
Anything that's in the trailer is fair game.
Yes. So, there is a Scream-type character going around town butchering people. Mm-hmm. And anyway, this happens in front of her. She reacts to it and kills... I'm not going to tell you how, because you need to watch the trailer for that. She kills our main killer. Mm-hmm. So that's it. It's done. The mm-hmm. film's over with. Until a year has passed and everything has gone wrong in her life, and she says she wishes she was never born. And then, of course, when she comes to, she had never been born and she hadn't had killed the killer.
Right.
So the killers carry on. Only she knows who it is, which it is revealed in the trailer, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It does feature... I'm a big fan of Justin Long. And it does feature Justin Long with the most amazing set of teeth. I don't know. I don't think they're real. Think Something About Mary.
Right.
Is it Matt Dillon?
Yes.
Matt Dillon. Think the veneers that he has in that. Justin Long has them in this. And they're just fantastic. They steal the movie on its own. But it looks great. It looks really enjoyable. This is the type of... I believe it's from the producers of Freaky, and I really enjoy Freaky.
There you go.
So it's right up my alley. This is the sort of thing that I really, really love.
Okay, that's headed to theatres in the US on the 10th of November. It's coming to the UK via Shudder, I believe, but we're still waiting on a date.
It is, yes. It'll be interesting to see where and how we get that one, because it's something I want to see.
Okay, next trailer.
Your Lucky Day.
So this is the late Angus Cloud's last film. It's his final film, his final performance. A lot of hype about this movie. Tell me more about it.
So this is literally, you know, we talk about certain types of film that I really like, and this is the type of film that I absolutely love. It's takes place in a convenience store in America, whatever we want to call them over here, a little corner shop, and there is the big $156 million lottery.
Yes. Okay. Right, okay, I'm with you now.
Somebody gets that winning ticket.
Okay.
And he's down on his luck. Things are not going right. He's at the end of his tether. He doesn't know what to do with his life until he's in the convenience store when somebody has their ticket scanned and is revealed they have won $156 million.
Oh, is this like a hostage-style scenario?
Yes. Ooh. So down on his luck, he decides to take that ticket in forceful ways. And things go downhill from there. And basically, it's about choices. What do you do, the right thing? Or do you do the thing that's going to earn you a lot of money?
I'm in. All the way sold.
It looks really, really good. I am completely in on this.
This is due, also, that's due here November 10th as
yep.
well. There we go.
Yep, same.
Excellent. All right, Your Lucky Day. November 10th for that, UK cinemas, I believe. Trailers online, you can check both trailers out now. And finally...
Argyle.
Yeah, finally! Finally, because this has been coming for so long. Matthew Vaughan's film. I know Lorne Balfe's been working on this for quite some time.
Now, the trailer looks fantastic, I will say that. I just want to mention one thing, and you can shoot me down if you want to shoot me down.
Mm-hmm.
Is this not the exact same story as the Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum film? With Brad Pitt. What was that? I can't even remember what
it was
called.
The Lost City.
That's it, yeah. Is it not exactly the same thing?
That's a crazy English billionaire.
It's about a novelist who writes spy thrillers.
Yes.
Which you think, when you see the world at first, you think that is that world, which is exactly the same as this. Then the actual novelist gets sucked into a real espionage thriller, which is the same as this.
Okay. The thing is, Argyle's been on the table for years, long before The Lost City. So I'm just wondering if someone else... Are we in an Armageddon and Deep Impact
exactly
scenario?
What I was going to say.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the line, was Argyle done, like you say, years ago? And someone else has been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for this film to drop. It's never going to drop. Why don't we carbon copy it?
Different studios.
Make it maybe a little bit funnier. And Sandra Bullock's...
I mean...
Because obviously this isn't... I don't believe... I'm sure it has funny moments, but I don't believe this is a comedy.
It's a Matthew Vaughn movie.
Yeah.
Matthew Vaughn, who makes Kingsman.
I know.
And Kick-Ass.
So that's what I'm saying. I wouldn't class it as a comedy, but it doesn't
mean it has... I think it will be very funny.
But it doesn't mean that... Yeah, but I wouldn't class it as a comedy.
It has a cat
in
a rucksack.
Now, listen, there's a difference between comedies and films with comedic moments in. You still wouldn't call it a comedy, would you?
I think more along the lines of Bullet Train.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call Bullet Train a comedy.
Oh, it's absolutely an action
comedy. No, it's not.
Absolutely it is.
It's an action movie that has comedic moments. It is not a comedy.
It's an action comedy. It literally is an action comedy. Okay, look.
We're going to end up falling out by the end of this podcast.
Right, so Argyle.
It looks great, by the way. It looks really
good.
Pound
for pound. I mean, I think I gave Lost City a 3 at best.
Yeah, I mean, it's very average. It has its funny moments, but it's a very average, perfect streaming film.
Okay. There is only so much I can say about Argyle. It's probably a lot better than The Lost City.
Yeah, well, listen. You don't need to be careful
about how I'm handling this.
Listen, you don't need insider knowledge to know that Argyle is probably going to be a little bit better than The Lost City.
I really like The Lost City.
I thought it was fine.
But I honestly think Argyle's the bigger movie.
Well, look, Matthew Vaughn is fantastic, and it's got a fantastic cast in this. But one of the main reasons why I really love this is I'm such a huge fan of Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, oh, Sam Rockwell, again, put Sam Rockwell in anything and it's automatically 2 stars
He's
better.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yes, he is. Honestly, there's so many... Dua Lipa's in this, Henry Cavill's in this.
This film has a lot of very pretty people.
I certainly hope you dance as well as you dress.
There's only one way to find out.
Put on your red shoes and dance the blues. You and I, we're not so different. Agent Argyle.
Little help? Hold on.
The book is phenomenal, sweetie, but... What happens next?
It's called a cliffhanger, Mother.
Ellie, it's called a cop-out.
It sounds good, it looks good. I think, for the record, officially... I think it's going to be very good, and I think a lot of people like it, and I know a lot of people have been waiting for this for a long time, I am super hyped for it.
You know, when we talk about judging a film by its cover, I think I'd be astounded if it's anything less than a 4.
Okay, we'll hold that on record.
I think it will be at minimum a 4, possibly even a 4 or 4.5, but I would be astounded if I go less than a 4 on this, because it just looks like a thoroughly enjoyable movie.
I am in no position to form a judgment, but I will say that sounds...
I can neither confirm nor deny this movie is going to be a 4 out of 5.
To reference another Lormbow franchise, I can neither confirm nor deny the Secretary's position on it. No, anyway, yeah, so speaking of... I completely forgot. This probably isn't on your sheet because I literally just found this out. But Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is on digital on the day that we recorded this podcast. Digital download. You can watch that at home in 4K right now. I'm saying this now because it won't come up on your notes later. No. So, yeah, while we're talking about Lorne Balfe, Argyle will be in UK cinemas in February next year. It's
so long.
It's going to be so good.
So long.
Honestly, it's going to be so good. Of course, there are going to be people that really don't like it, but that's up to them. I'm telling you,
those people are wrong.
That this is going to be amazing. Okay.
Everyone's entitled to a wrong opinion.
But yes, on the subject of Lorne Balfe, Argyle will come to cinemas with another wonderful score from him in February, and his other score, which was probably the best of the year, Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning Part 1. That film you can now watch at home as of today, the day we recorded this podcast. It's on digital download 4K. So Blu-ray, DVD, and 4K details to follow. I will let you know. I'm def- definitely going to let you know, because Paul will knows I'm going to come running in with it and tap it against the microphone and do all that. Look what I've got. Because, yes. But in the meanwhile, you can watch at home right now. Okay, that's that. Let's fire through what's coming to the cinemas on Friday.
Coming to the cinema, we have got Smoke Sauna Sisterhood, which sounds like a fantastic film. Friday the 13th, which is the original. What anniversary is that?
I don't think it is anniversary. I think it's just
been because it's Friday the 13th.
Yeah, because when was that? 82 that came out. So yeah, it would be
was that 80, somewhere around there.
1980 maybe. I don't know, but it is Friday the 13th. So
Cassius X becoming Ali, which is something that is right up my alley. Lies We Tell. Dali Land.
Mm-hmm.
Silver Dollar Road, the Taylor Swift The Eras Tour, which is just going to blow everything out the box office. And by the way, I have not got a disliking for Taylor Swift. I like Taylor Swift.
They moved Exorcist Believer.
I know, it's crazy.
Because of it.
Yeah.
Which is why I thought we probably should mention it.
Mean Streets, 50th anniversary.
Mean Streets.
50 years old.
A Scorsese masterpiece. Mad. Returns to the cinema. 4K restoration.
Absolutely mad. Some Other Hood.
Which I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah.
At time of recording, we haven't seen it yet, but we will do by the time we release our next episode. So we'll talk more about that at the time because it looks amazing.
Yeah, very, very, Love very Adam. Much. Yeah, Adam yeah. Deacon, superb.
Yeah. Okay.
And the Miracle Club.
And the Miracle Club, which again we'll talk about when we record next. We're gonna do. Let's fire through some reviews because I know we're kind of. This week we are very pushed for time, so we're just kind of going to zip through these real quick. But we did see some movies that we did want to share our thoughts with you on. The first one of which was...
Let's talk about The Great Escaper, which I think is fair to say is both of our favourites from the week.
I think so, yeah. I think so. I think we both agreed pretty much on the same score as well. It's a really, really, really lovely film. It's directed by Oliver Parker, a different Oliver Parker than we discussed, by the way.
Is it really?
We were getting them confused.
With
Ol Parker. This is Oliver Parker, who was, I believe, a character in Nightbreed, Clive Barker's Nightbreed. And I think he's the character that goes, "You can't go down there!" He's that guy. Yeah, he directed. He's looking at me really blankly. Have you never seen Clive Barker's Nightbreed?
No.
What a film. You need to seek that out.
Okay.
I can't believe we managed to compare Nightbreed to Michael Caine's excellent performance in this beautiful film.
Oliver Parker. He is in Nightbreed, from 1990, by the way.
Yeah, what a film. Seek that out. You'll really like it.
Okay.
It's right up your alley. Okay. Anyway, back to The Great Escaper. So this is the true story.
But before you start on this, by the way, can I interject? He also directed, bearing in mind what we're about to talk about and the type of film The Great Escaper is, he also directed Johnny English Reborn, Dad's Army, and St. Trinian's 2.
There you go.
Talk about a range.
British institution movies, basically. Well, I think this is as well, because we are essentially talking about something that really happened.
Yeah.
This is the true story of Bernie, who famously made the UK papers, at least famously made the UK press for, at the ripe old age of, I think, nearly, was he 88, 89?
It was
late 80s. I want to say escaped, which is why it's that in the title, but a bit of subterfuge was required to get out of his nursing home, cross the channel and go to France so that he could show up and be with his comrades for the 70th anniversary of D-Day. So this is a thing that really actually happened. So Sir Michael Caine, playing Bernie here in the film, and beautifully, beautifully so, Glenda Jackson, her final performance. She died just a few months after the film was made. The late Glenda Jackson, who gives an all-time career high.
Yeah, I think that Michael Caine is so good in this, he possibly steals the performance away from Glenda ever so slightly, but Glenda is fantastic in
this. They have such a great rapport together as husband and wife. It's a very sweet film. They are both pensioners, as I say, they're in their 80s. And I love how part of this, her hand in helping him escape, in that, you know, she's very canned, not very canned. She's a very sort of, the subterfuge is there, do you know what I mean? In terms of when the carers are looking for him and she sort of goes, oh, he's just popped out to the shops. And kind of the way she plays along, because she loves him so much. Yeah. And I think,
oh, is he not around? Is he?
Oh,
is he
not? Oh, I've not seen him. Yeah. The fish and chips thing as well, absolutely flawless.
Brilliant.
But their relationship is beautiful. I mean, it works on two levels, really, this film, I thought. Their relationship is incredibly beautiful and they play it off very, very well. The literal, when people say, oh, love's not dead, you know, when true love's not dead, we make a passing comment to a young couple in the street or whatever, but this is old school romance. This is an old school married couple who are still deeply in love with each other decades and decades later. And we get to see a little bit of backstory about how that came to be. But also we get to see flashbacks of his experiences in World War II on the beach and stuff. The other level it works on, of course, is his journey, not just to France, but within himself. And I think that's where a lot of the film's beauty comes from. Obviously, like, the score by Craig Armstrong and the beautiful cinematography all helps as well. Some of those shots are probably some of the most perfectly framed shots I've seen in years. It is a gloriously lovely film. Is it predictable? Very much so. That, I would say, is my only minor criticism. Yeah. Outside of that, it's beautiful, flawless, lovely, life-affirming, and just wonderful.
Yeah, I'll agree with all of that 100%. Michael Caine's fantastic. Glenda Jackson's fantastic. These scenes with them together, the scenes with Michael Caine making his escape and all of that is fantastic. You know, it really does capture some of the struggles that veterans go through.
Yeah.
Mentally, of course, and physically as well. The flashback scenes, which easily could have been cheaped out, which easily could have been throwaway scenes, were not.
No, they were like 1917 level.
Yeah, they were brilliant.
The quality that went into the filmmaking.
Like you say, is it a little maybe cheesy or predictable, like you say? Yes, it is. That doesn't detract from the film. You mentioned it, you know, we spoke about this as we were walking out, is a lot of films like this will literally poke you with a stick and say, go on, cry, cry, this is the bit where you cry.
Yeah.
This film doesn't do that at all.
No, it's very organic.
And I did cry.
It's such a beautiful film. I really liked it. I think that's easily our film of the week, unless you're giving that to Paw Patrol.
Paw Patrol was better than I thought it was going to be, and it's okay, but it's not as good as The Great Escaper.
I think we're there with the film of the week already. The Great Escaper, that has a 12A certificate. It's in UK cinemas, hopefully making its way to theatres around the world as well. I hope that gets a wider release worldwide, or there's some way that our friends across in various countries can get hold of
it. If you're listening and you don't live in England, when it makes its release, wherever it's going to make its release, then search it out, because it's a great little film.
But see it on a big screen, because the cinematography is breathtaking.
If you can, see it on a big screen.
I think we agreed on 4 stars for that.
Yes, I would 100% agree on that. Yep.
4 out of 5 for The Great Escaper. That's the cinemas. Now let's move quickly through The Exorcist Believer.
Yes, and I'm a believer.
I think everybody kind of knows about this by now, but just to very briefly recap on it, this picks up the legacy of The Exorcist. David Gordon Green, who directed the recent three Halloween movies, the Halloween trilogy that happened recently, of course, the Halloween sort of brand, didn't it, came under the ownership of Blumhouse. And again, that's that partnership between Jason Blum, Danny McBride, David Gordon Green, Universal Pictures, and they recaptured the essence of Halloween and made 3 more movies. They've done that again with this, with The Exorcist. They've bought The Exorcist. They're going to make a trilogy of new films which pick up from the legacy, quite literally. Chris McNeil's character, of course, Ellen Burstyn's character, who played Reagan's mum in the original
Chris,
50 years ago, Chris. She appears in this movie. Of course, that's not a spoiler. She's in the trailer. But this gives us a new setting. It kind of felt like it was a Halloween movie with demonic possession in it, right? The way some of the streets were shot and stuff like that. It had very Halloween-esque
vibes. He obviously has a style, doesn't he?
Yeah, so for anyone that knows anything about this, two girls go to the woods after school, deceive their parents because they want to have a muck about. I mean, usually it's a Ouija board, but this is kind of the same thing. And that they want to.
It's a seance light version.
Yeah, seance light version. They go to the woods and they end up missing for 3 days and 3 nights. Creates a citywide search for them. Lots of panicked parents. Community galvanized, looking panicked, worried for these girls. They are found 30 miles up the road in a barn. And according to the girls, they've only been gone a few hours. What's happened? They've been to the other side. That's what happened. Or apparently to hell and back. Because what they bring back with them is something entirely demonic.
She knows who I am. Where's the other girl?
Taking care of her at home.
That's not a good idea.
So there we go. That's your setup for Exorcist Believer. What do we think?
Can we talk about the good things first? Let's try and be positive. Let's talk about the good things. Leslie Odom Jr. is fantastic.
Yeah.
Jennifer Nettles is great as well.
Anne Dowd.
Anne Dowd is great. Ellen Burstyn, great. When these people come in, they give their performances. You can't knock the performances in this.
Cinematography was great as well. We'll get round the good bit. Cinematography I really enjoyed.
The young girls, Olivia O'Neill and Lydia Jewett. That was one of my main disappointing things about the film, is I thought the girls were so great that it didn't show them enough.
Yeah, a little underused.
Yeah,
that's fair enough. I would agree with that. But there were so many elements about it I did like. I really do feel that this is the best sequel that the original's ever had. I mean, the original, again, we'll go back to movies like The Godfather.
Yeah.
Like, you know, The Exorcist 1, I say The Exorcist 1, but
the original
Billy Friedkin movie sits on its own.
It's arguably the greatest horror film ever made. If it's not the greatest, it's certainly in the top five.
So sequels are going to have a really hard job.
Yes.
Even coming anywhere close. Yes. This doesn't do that. I don't think it's on a par with the first one.
Not even close.
I think it's trying to be something different. And this is where the division comes in, you see. And I was talking to Brendan McCarthy about this yesterday, about how we're trying to walk that tightrope. And for a filmmaker, you have to sort of lean into a little bit and understand their process. From a filmmaker's point of view, from the studio's point of view, Danny McBride, of course, wrote this with David Gordon Green. You have to look at, they're trying to walk that tightrope of keeping the one side happy, the fans of the original happy, the purists happy, because if you don't do certain things, they're going to torches and pitchforks. But on the other side, you want to do something new with
exactly.
this and fresh. And the problem is you lean too far into the new stuff, the nostalgia goes. But if you lean too far in the nostalgia, new audiences go, well, this is just trying to be
but
the
But certain
one.
Films have done it perfectly recently. Scream 5 was my one for me. Scream 5 was perfect.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters, which I know is not a horror film, but Ghostbusters was done perfectly.
Afterlife. Yeah,
was
yeah.
done perfectly as well. So that's two examples there of something where you take a franchise that's 20, 30, however many years old,
mm-hmm.
and you create a perfect sequel. This is not that.
Okay.
This is not that, unfortunately.
I mean, have you seen the other sequels?
No, I haven't.
This is definitely the better of the sequels.
Yeah. And this is not like a bad film. I know other people have really gone in on this,
No, we enjoyed it reasonably, I think.
I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. I thought it had some good points. I thought it had a lot of bad points. Like we said, I think we both agree on this, one of my real negatives from this film is there's no, it goes from 0 to 100. The girls are fine 1 minute and then they are literally demonically possessed to the
There's
no, one of the great things about The Exorcist is the fact that Regan over a number
wind.
Of days or maybe even weeks becomes worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, and you see her, you know, going down the stairs in the spider and up in
which
the corner
of the film.
Which was
cut for years. And, they only
and all
put
of that
back.
Type of stuff is the best stuff about The Exorcist, whereas this doesn't have that. This literally goes from two girls not feeling too well and being a bit naughty to, oh my God, they're the spawn of Satan. There's no in-between.
Yeah, and I think you're right, this is the pacing. Like,
yes.
When it starts, it's very... And see, all the stuff of them, the backstory with their mom, with... Angela's mum and all this kind of stuff, that was interesting. The character I would have liked a little bit more. In some cases there was a little too much world building, do you know what I mean? Like it went really slow, which was fine, I'm fine with, because you're kind of but then it went really, really slow and then all of a sudden we were at an exorcism and it kind of, yeah, I think pacing was off.
I've literally just looked it up and it's an hour and 51 minutes long.
Okay.
Which is a good timing.
Mm. But there were other elements that I did enjoy. Like the editing, by the way, some of that editing, the editing in itself forces a jump scare. And that has a lot in common with the first movie, because the first movie does that really, really well. The kind of jump scare editing, that works really well, I think, effectively. David Wingo and Aman Abbasi's score, of course, that was great. The score, they really went in on experimentation. They worked really, really hard on trying to make this something that was completely its own. Of course, there's elements of Tubular Bells in there, which you would expect.
Yes.
But ultimately, musically, it's note perfect. I really, really like this score. So much so, we've got them coming up on a future episode of Scoreheads. But the movie itself, I think I really liked it, but I think it could have been so much more.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I will go with a 3.
I was literally agreeing with you there. Yep, Exorcist Believer, that is in cinemas and theatres now. We're going to say 3 out of 5. That's us. We'll touch on Paw Patrol because I know you mentioned it a couple of times before, but just to kind of come back around to it very quickly, because it is now out in UK cinemas.
Yeah, it had some limited screenings previously for the last few weeks, but it's now out countrywide, worldwide for everybody to see. it's a Paw Patrol movie. If you have kids, which I assume would be the only reason you're going to the cinema to watch this.
So hey.
If you have kids, you will have seen Paw Patrol at some point. And remember that Paw Patrol episode that was 10 minutes long? It's now an hour and 30 minutes long.
He's looking at me like, I'm so relieved that he went. He took his whole family to the press screening. And I just remember thinking to myself, that's a really lovely thing, number one. Number two, I don't have to go. Because the last Paw Patrol movie, I did have to go. And there's something to be said for a man in his 40s sat on his own in a screening of Paw Patrol. I'm so glad you went and you took actual small people. That is who it's actually for.
It's literally who it's aimed at. Yeah. So just very, very, very quickly, a meteor crashes in Adventure City. It gives the Paw Patrol pups superpowers because it's a mighty movie and that transforms them into the Mighty Pups. And they save the day. You know, I hope it's not a
spoiler.
I hope it's not a spoiler.
Spoiler!
But shock horror, the pups saved the day.
You're taking us off the air because you've spoiled Paw Patrol.
But look, it's fine.
I'm leaving now. Spoil Paw Patrol!
And welcome to the Paul Marsh podcast.
You've got your own podcast. I'm another one.
But look,
right, good.
If you are dragged to the cinema to watch the Paw Patrol movie, which if you've got young kids, you will be, don't worry. It's going to be fine. It's not as bad as what you are thinking. In fact, I sat and watched it and laughed a handful of times, enjoyed it. Is it up there with the greatest cartoons of all time? No, it's not. But it is also not up there with the worst kids' movies of all times, of which there are plenty.
Now, hang on. This might be your son's five stars.
Well, I know for a fact it is, because whilst we did go to the premiere 2-3 weeks ago, whenever it was, it's his birthday next week and we're going this Saturday to watch it again.
Whoa, it's some kind of fireball. Well, that makes sense. You're a fire pup. I wonder what your power is. Huh? Chase?
Marshall, up here!
Hey, how'd you get over there so fast?
Get over where?
Great. Now the clumsy pup shoots fireballs out of his paws.
Cool! I'm a wrecking ball!
There you go. That's exactly who it's aimed at. My son's about to turn 6. That's exactly who it's aimed at. He loved it. If you've got children of a similar age, they will love it. You will not hate it. There are a few jokes in there that are really funny. It's an absolutely fine movie. From my point of view as an adult, I can't give it any more than a 3. However, like you say, my son would 100% give it a 5 out of 5.
There you go. And balance is restored. Paw Patrol in cinemas and UK theatres now. Okay, time now for the big interview. I'm talking to Pete Laverty and Dave Turner. Pete Laverty, of course, is Ken Loach's long-term writing partner on a brilliant film called The Old Oak. Dave Turner is the star of that film, or one of the main stars of the movie. And I called up with them to talk all about the film.
This has now become a dumping ground, lads.
You're right.
Land losses, dumping ground.
Aye, you're right there. Them people that are buying the places, they're not bothered, they're not doing the houses up.
No.
And the people who are moving in, well, they're not. It's not their property at the end of the day. Right. They're not doing them up. They're just being left to wreck and ruin.
I just don't know what to say. I mean, me and Mary, we've been in this village all our lives.
I know you have.
You know, and is this going to be it, like the rest of our lives, are living?
Oh, no way,
No way.
Trolley, look.
Time now to welcome on today's very special guest, the writer and one of the stars of celebrated director Ken Loach's compelling new film, The Old Oak. The writer of the film, Paul Laverty, and co-lead actor, Dave Turner. Good morning to you both. How are you doing?
Morning.
Morning, John. We're great. We had a fantastic screening and premiere last night in London, and it's always lovely to share 4 years' graft with friends and colleagues and many, many, many people who came along to support us. So it's lovely to get it out and to say thanks to Studio Canal too, who are really pushing the boat out in this one, and it's going to open all over the country. So a big thanks to them as well.
Thank you both for joining us as well to talk about the film. And Paul, we'll start with you actually, if that's okay, by asking quite simply about your inspirations or motivation behind writing the story and what ideas you were passing back and forth with Ken to bring the film into existence, essentially.
Well, after I, Daniel Blake, and Sorry I Missed You, you know, both filmed in the Northeast, we just felt there was unfinished business. Those last two films are very tough, they're almost tragedies, but you've got to be loyal to the premise and those characters. But we wanted to examine the notion of hope. How do we nourish each other? And when Ken was up for another film, and he's a... I mean, this film would exhaust a 30-year-old, but never mind a sprightly octogenarian. So when he did decide to dive in and have another crack at it, I went up to the Northeast and dug around and spoke to many, many people. But I was attracted by these villages, ex-mining villages, where you met the old people who were involved in the miners' strike in 84. We've seen these communities decimated, the state is retracted, there's hardly a post office or a bank or even a church or a church hall anywhere. And so many of these people who lived there, they felt alienated, and many, they were dumping people there who had been kicked out of other parts of the country, often lost souls, often causing chaos. So the people who lived there, you know, they felt hard done by, and we have to listen to them and understand their frustrations. So when asylum seekers were put in there because of the cheap housing, let's say they got a mixed review, a mixed reception, and what was remarkable were the people who lived there, people who would hold out the hand of friendship. They not only tried to understand people coming from a war zone, but they realised they had to build bridges with the local community. I mean, it's remarkable in the UK, there's so much hunger. The Syrians didn't expect to find communities with hunger in these communities. There's 3,000 food banks in this country, shamefully. And so it's a story that looks at the delicate relationships between two different communities. And we felt this was a big canvas, a big challenge. And luckily, the secret to the whole story is through the eyes of TJ Ballantyne, played beautifully by my friend Dave beside me.
Dave, tell us about your character, TJ, and his role within this story.
Yeah, TJ is a man who's sort of on the edge. His career, his life is going in a downward spiral. He owns the pub, which is the last public space in the village. It's literally clinging on. He has, you know, he doesn't have the money to sustain the pub. His life is not great. His family is, he's not in touch with his family anymore. And into this comes the Syrian families, and this is the first chance he sees in a long time where there's a chance to do good. There's an element of hope and optimism. And because of the way that it's filmed, and because of the fabulous script written by Paul, as the film progresses, because Ken obviously shoots in sequence, you know, I was able to find out more and more about the character and the layers behind him and underneath him. So it was a very, very challenging time. It was, I've said this so many times, it was an honour and a privilege to be part of it. It's an incredible experience. I must pay tribute to the fellow actors, the crew, because without them I couldn't have got through this. You know, and Ebla Marie, who plays Yara in the film, is absolutely incredible, wonderful person, incredible actor, and it was just an absolute joy to go through the process with Ebla and learn about the characters as we went along.
I have to say, Dave, your performance in this is incredible, as is Ebla's. I did want to pass that across while we had the conversation to talk about that. And what was it like working on, you mentioned it just a little moment ago there, but what was it like working not only with your cast and crew, but for both of you really, what's it like working with Ken every day?
Well, he's a remarkable character. I mean, it's hard to believe this is into his sixth decade. He actually had his 86th birthday in a wonderful scene that we shot in Durham Cathedral, so a big thank you for allowing us to shoot there. It's a wonderful scene, and to be doing something at that level, trying to draw together so much at the age of 86, was a remarkable achievement. And he's as sharp as ever, bright as ever, but first and foremost, he's just great company as well, having great talent, and actors throughout all the 14 films we've done together, I've just revelled in it. He creates a space where people have confidence, but they will save more.
Yeah, I mean, without having any previous acting experience, to be put in this position was incredibly challenging. But Ken, in conjunction with the entire crew, creates such an incredibly friendly, welcoming space that you're able to show your vulnerability and you're able to lay your emotions bare, which wasn't easy. But he creates this atmosphere where there's no fear of failure. If something goes wrong, he just says, "Don't worry, it's only film. Let's go again." There's no criticism, but the trust he puts in you as an individual is incredible. And I've said this before, and I've said it again, My overarching ambition when I started on this was, at the end of it, I wanted to be able to say that, you know, I haven't let Ken down. And that was the main motivation all the way through, because you have such love and admiration for the man and you don't want to let him down. And I know I can speak behalf, we've said this numerous times, you know, the other cast members, we all felt the same. You know, it was an honour to be part of it. We all had a pretty good idea it was going to be his last film. So we wanted to try and make sure that we'd give it everything that we could, you know, in honour of Ken. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, again, an incredible experience. Just very, very, very lucky and honoured to be part of it.
It was funny, John, last night at the premiere in London, Dave Bradley came along. People might remember him as the young 14-year-old in Kiss. I think that was 1969. He was there last night at the age of 70. So it was lovely to see new actors coming through and so many from other previous films. We've had the obviously, I didn't do Kiss, but it was lovely to see, you know, the history of film stretch out in that room last night, Dave, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I'd met David a few months previously, but to see him again last night, you know, I won't repeat what he said to me because it wasn't probably fit for public consumption. But he was in tears. He was in tears. You know, at the end of the film, David was in tears. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I take a great deal of, I'm not going to say pleasure in making him cry, but I take a great deal of confidence from that somebody of his stature was overwhelmed by the film. So I'm just saying it's greatly honoured by the whole experience.
And I have a quick shout out, John, briefly, because many of the other important, equally important part of all this is the wonderful contribution by our Syrian actors. And Dave, you mentioned Ebla before. We had to find all the families and the kids all local, and what these people have lived through, what they've come from, and their generosity to share their lives and shoot with us and to revisit some of those memories was absolutely exceptional. We met some really remarkable people, and I'll always be profoundly grateful to them.
It's an incredible film of which you should all be very, very proud. Thank you both for your time, and wishing you every success with the rest of the campaign for the film.
Very kind of you, John. Thank you
very much, Noel.
This is solidarity. This is about, we'll do something together.
It takes a strength to build something new. It takes strength to build something beautiful.
Shukran. Do you know what shukran means? It means thank you.
Shukran.
Shukran.
Pete Laverty and Dave Turner there talking about Ken Loach's brilliant film, The Old Oak, which is in select cinemas right now. Do go and check it out. You really enjoyed it as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Don't get me wrong.
I mean, enjoy is probably the wrong word.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah.
It's not an enjoyable film, but it's a very intriguing,
very well made
film.
Very
yeah.
well written film. And of course, like all Ken Loach's film, holds up a mirror to our society as it is now. It's called The Old Oak. It is out now. Okay, what's next?
Right, so we're going to be looking at streaming, because literally we have mentioned a few times that apparently people are streaming now, which I find astounding.
You came back around to that. I would have forgotten that you said that, to be honest.
But I just was astounded that I even mentioned it at the start of the show. Did you know people are streaming now?
Did you know Paul Marsh has a time machine and went back and invented streaming?
Because
apparently he's just discovered it for the first time.
At home,
ever.
I play TV on a black and white reel with the piano playing,
you know,
in the background.
Ding, ding, ding. It's because Netflix sent out their last DVD the other week and now he doesn't know what to do. Anyway, yeah, go on. So right. What's happening this week?
On streaming, we got Girl Gone Bad, which of course is going to Amazon Prime, and we will be talking about that a little bit more very shortly. Payback, which of course is on ITVX, which again,
thriller,
we'll be
yeah.
talking about in a second or two. Mr. Dress Up, The Magic of Make-Believe, is coming to Amazon Prime. Now, this is the one that I'm excited for. The Fall of the House of Usher is coming to Netflix.
We got the Newton Brothers coming to Scoreheads as well, who scored the show. They're going to talk all about it. So check that out on Scoreheads, which is our other podcast on this channel.
I'm such a huge fan of Mike Flanagan. I'm such a huge fan. Yeah. I've loved all of his previous work, both movies and TV series. And huge fan. So can't wait for that to come out. Hopefully, I look forward to talking about that next week. Conference is on Netflix. The Burial is Amazon Prime. Lessons in Chemistry is Apple TV. Yeah, I think that's about it.
That's our roundup for now. Let's get more into the ITVX and ITV1 here in the UK series Payback. Brand new from Jed Mercurio. Of course, he of Line of Duty. I spoke to Morven Christie, the star of Payback, to find out more about the show. And I'm super excited now to welcome onto the show one of the stars of exciting new ITV drama Payback, Morven Christie. Welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Doing very, very well, thank you. Excited for this show. Thank you so much for joining us to talk all about it. It's a thrilling, thrilling new show. And I think we'll start right at the beginning, actually, and ask you, in your own words, how would you describe the show?
So it's a psychological thriller, very twisty-turny psychological thriller about a woman, a just happy mum living in the suburbs whose husband is murdered. And then she very quickly discovers that he was not quite who she thought he was. And he's been involved in laundering money and possibly pocketing some money from an organized crime group. So she finds herself stuck in between police investigations and the leader of this criminal gang, and trying to find a way to get herself and her little children out of it.
What was it about the script? It's clearly quite an exciting script. What is it about the script and also Lexi herself that drew you to wanting to say yes to being involved?
Well, when it came through, it was from Jed Mercurio's company. So you kind of knew that there was going to be, you kind of know right away with that name, the type of show that it's going to be. And this one's quite different because it's character led. So there is that procedural element, but it's much more emotional than Line of Duty, for example, which is really like a exciting sort of procedural show. This kind of like walks the tightrope between them. So there was that. And also I just really loved the idea of this character who right at the beginning of the drama is sort of plunged into, you know, her husband is murdered and she's plunged into this quite extreme grief. And so anything that happens to her from that point on is happening on top of this grief. And it just felt like for me as an actor, it felt like a super exciting challenge. It just felt like something I could kind of really dig right into, and I always want that.
I'm very well at that, I must say. You're working alongside excellent company in this as well, including the legendary Peter Mullen. What was it like working with not just Peter but the rest of the cast and crew on this production?
So honestly, this is one of the loveliest casts I've ever been in. Just some really, really clever, really committed actors. And it was a tough process and everyone just kind of brought like a real commitment that was quite unusual, I think. And I've got some great friends in this cast. Peter, I knew a little bit before we shot this. I'd never worked with him, but he's professionally kind of a hero of mine. And just personally, I really like the guy, you know, he's really good company. So knowing that he was doing it already was a big draw for me, just to get to work with him. And it was so much more than I could hope for, actually, that element of it. Just, I had so much support and love in this cast. It was really special from that perspective. It was great.
Serious story, and in your case, part like this is understandably quite intense. You're talking there just about having a lot of grief, and I wondered, was there any laughter and camaraderie between the takes? Did everyone very much stay in character? Did we break character, have a bit of a giggle? How did it work?
Oh my God, no. It was like a comedy show. Like, I don't do that. I can't do that. I don't think it helps the crew. I don't think it helps performances. It just doesn't. You've got to keep it light, and you've got to sort of remember that it's a playroom basically, and that everyone needs to be able to play. And so if everyone's afraid and everything's too serious, no one can really take risks, and the work just gets a bit sort of sticky and weird, you know. So no, we had a lot of laughs. And you know, Peter is a big patter guy, so like it's not serious when Peter's around.
What do you do to relax, actually, after performing a serious dramatic part like this?
After, as in like when I go home at night?
Yeah.
Sit in a darkened room. No, I this was great for me because we were filming this in Glasgow, which is where I live at the moment. So I could go home every night to my partner and my dogs, and that was great. Like I just go home and, you know, watch Only Murders in the Building and have some dinner and a bath and then go to sleep. Like, it's all just very normal and very chill.
And just finally, before we go, we'll finish as we always do by asking, what do you hope audiences will take away from seeing this show?
I hope that they get a really good twisty-turny ride, as you would expect from something that's got Jed involved. But I hope also that they feel something for the characters.
It's a great show. Morven, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on a brilliant show, and hope it's a huge, huge success for you all. Thank you.
Thanks, mate. Thanks so much for having me.
Morven Christie there, talking all about... She's lovely, isn't she?
Yes, absolutely.
She's amazing. The show is now on ITV1, I think Wednesday night. I want to say Wednesday nights at 9 here in the UK. You can catch it on ITVX, though, of course. I think all episodes are up now. You can watch it as a box set, I think. Don't quote me. There might only be a couple up there. ITVX, though, is your destination for that. Thank you very much to Morven again. Okay, where are we? Paul on the sheets.
There's a lot of great stuff on ITVX, by the way. ITVX has got some really good stuff.
You really did.
I've done quite a few, some very, very good things on there. Right, so looking at digital 4K Blu-rays, DVDs.
Read me the list! Read! Preach to me, preach!
Halloween Trilogy, I assume that's the new trilogy.
That's the David Gordon Green trilogy,
right, okay.
Yes.
Hotel Transylvania, Transformania.
Can I just say the Halloween Trilogy box set, by the way, is a limited edition steelbook library case, and it's got loads of art cards in it. So if you're a big horror collector, it's 4K, that's your go-to.
Okay. What's the deal with Transformania coming to digital and DVD? Because that's been out for ages.
I think it went to Netflix, didn't it? I think it went directly to streaming.
Now
it's physical, yeah.
Did you know that is Adam Sandler's biggest grossing film? Not that one, but the Hotel Transylvania. Of all the films Adam Sandler has made, that's the biggest grossing film.
I can believe the first one, yeah.
It's mad.
For sure.
Medusa Deluxe, Mother and Son, Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, Transformers Rise of the Beasts, coming to DVD, 4K and Blu-ray, as well as A Good Person, which
we loved,
which came out at the start of the year,
yeah,
again to streaming only, I want to say Sky.
Yeah, it went to the cinema, then it went to Sky. It's now out on Blu-ray, digital and DVD. It's one of our films of the year.
We both gave it a 5 out of 5. It
5-star movie.
Just a fantastic, beautiful, beautiful film.
Yeah. Elemental's also out with a steelbook, so it's I think it's Blu-ray, DVD and digital, but there's also a Blu-ray steelbook or a 4K steelbook. That's from Disney. Of course, that, I mean, we've talked about that loads.
We have.
I think you gave it a 3, didn't you? 3 out of 5 for that.
Yeah, it's fine. Nice.
And then the other one was...
The 100 Years of Warner Brothers.
So I was chuckling to myself while I was putting the sheet together, because I realised that when I sent it to him, he's going to have to read out the list of the films that are in it. Okay, so this, going back to a previous episode, this was the 30 film 4K deluxe box set we talked about that was marginally cheaper than the other one from Disney. So what is in the 4K collector set? Go.
We are not going to comment on a single one of these films and just
read
the titles.
No, we have not
out,
got
right?
that time.
Okay, ready, here we go. 2001, A Space Odyssey, Casablanca, Citizen Kane, Cool Hand Luke, East of Eden, Maltese Falcon, Rebel Without a Cause, Rio Bravo, Singing in the Rain, The Wizard of Oz, Clockwork Orange, Batman, Beetlejuice, Blade Runner, Enter the Dragon, Exorcist, Goonies, Superman, Shining, Willy Wonka, Star is Born, Argo, Elvis, Goodfellas, It, Mad Max Fury Road, The Matrix, Shawshank Redemption, Training Day, Unforgiven, and Breathe.
Now, Warner Brothers, whichever of your number sent me that wonderful Exorcist box set the other day, you know what to do. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's out this week as well, so you can finally get that. We did have a debate about it, didn't we? But it's now available to buy, so check that out. Right, that's DVDs done.
Time for our final interview.
Are we there already? Okay, I caught up with filmmaker Kevin Schultz. He worked on DC's The Flash, did you know? We'll talk more about that in a second, though. His film is out now on Amazon Prime, and I caught up with him to talk more about it. And time now to welcome a very special guest for today's show. Joining me all the way from Vancouver, Canada, filmmaker Kevin Schultz. Kevin, how are you, sir?
Oh, I am lovely, especially after that wonderful introduction.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's great to have you here, man. I'm very excited about it. Tell us about yourself. For those at home hearing about you for the first time, tell us a little bit about you, your background, and give us the rundown.
All right. Well, I grew up in a relatively small town called Mission in a province called British Columbia in Canada. Went to a high school, actually the same high school as Carly Rae Jepsen, the Call Me Maybe person.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I went to the same high school. a number of years apart. But so I grew up in Mission. I was doing the film program from a very early time. I was never good at academics, but I was quite good at making art. So that was so that's what got me into film school afterwards. And yeah, I did, you know, the film school thing. Immediately went to PA work after that. Been working in the Vancouver film industry for over 10 years, the last seven of which were spent being what's called a video playback operator on the TV series The Flash, which recently had its finale. That was a wonderful 7 years to work on. From there, the pandemic hit. I had always wanted to make movies. I always wanted to make a feature. I had a goal about making my first feature before I was 30. We planned for it. The pandemic hit. Then in BC, we had a moment where it was like, oh, we're going to open things up so we can have up to 50 people in a room. And that was our window. So we took the opportunity and produced one of the very first feature films to be produced during the 2020 pandemic.
Okay.
And that is the movie that I'm here to talk about today.
Nice. That, I love that. That's like that preloaded background, and you took us all the way to the movies. Can we just do podcasts, you and I, forevermore? That's it. I love that. You've got it nailed. I want to talk about your passion for movies and where your passion for filmmaking came from. What kind of movies did you love growing up? What inspired you about filmmaking that made you want to become a filmmaker?
Man, you know, they always try to say things like, oh, it was that moment I saw Godfather for the first time. Or, it's always these super iconic movies. I'm going to tell you right now, the movies that I was watching on VHS, the most prestige movie when I was growing up was probably Jurassic Park. Like,
yeah.
It was. But for me, though, I'm 31 years old. So for me, the moment that I knew I wanted to pick up a camera and make movies was when my older brother took me to go see the first Spider-Man movie in 2002.
Oh, wow.
And I left that movie, and that was the first time, like, I noticed things up to this point. I'd always had a very strong imagination. And funnily enough, before actually making movies or learning how to do it with like a Hi8 camera back in the day, I used to, in my cul-de-sac, play pretend that I was pretending to be a director with my friends pretending to be actors. So it was like, that was the pretend games I was playing. And like, I'm not kidding. Like, we had full, like, oh my God, we need a production meeting. Cause I learned the term production meeting when I was like 8 years old.
That's
so
amazing.
I just kept saying that every time. So I went to go see Spider-Man with my brother. And I was always a big Spider-Man fan. The 90s cartoon was a big thing in our childhood. So seeing that movie, and that was the first time that I really got to see what I perceived at the age of 10 is like actual stakes, actual dialogue, actual acting. And maybe it's because it had to be put in costumes for me to understand it at that age. But all of a sudden, I'm some 10-year-old kid preaching the word of Willem Dafoe. Like, this is, you know, it's the accessibility of that and the camera angles, everything. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. Seeing Sam Raimi go through the streets like that and follow Spidey and swing. Like, these are things you never expected to see. And that was a moment where I just knew, like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I have to do that. You know what I mean?
And now you're here with your own.
And now I'm here
with your own movie, with your own movie. That's awesome. Tell us about the movie. What's it called? What's it about? Give us more details.
The movie is called Girl Gone Bad. It is currently out in the UK as well as the US and Canada. What it's about is there's this girl named Samantha, played incredibly by Alison Thornton. And I got to name drop her here for a moment because she is just an outstanding actor in this. And I really hope people can watch it, at least for a performance. Plays a woman named Samantha, who is a 16-year-old teenage girl about to have a date night with her high school girlfriend that nobody knows about. Little does she know, her high school girlfriend just got killed. And the killer is now on the way to her house. So when the killer arrives, that night that was supposed to be her big date night with her girlfriend turns into a night where she keeps a killer hostage in her basement while she's trying to figure out every step of her next plan. And it all takes place in one night. It's all just a big powder keg of getting more and more intense. You know, more people show up, and it kind of has you grasping at the limits of control of when you think to yourself, like, what is she going to do at this point? She's not, you know, she's 16 years old and now grieving and now dealing with all this that she put herself into. And I mean, as we all know, in our teenage years, we were all so perfectly rationally minded back then. So, but the movie was honestly the very first pitch that I ever gave was to our cinematographer slash editor, James Clark. Him and I had made a number of short films and music videos together at this point. And I texted him and I said, what if it's a movie where the killer's running away from the final girl? Like, I was watching Halloween and I thought, what if this whole movie is Michael Myers being like, oh crap, I didn't think about this, and all of a sudden is trying to run away from Laurie Strode the whole time?
That's an awesome idea. Where, how did it come to be? What was kind of the inspiration for it?
I've always been a big horror fan, and the way I approach certain movies and the way I approach certain scripts is always like, I have a tendency to do, you know, what if A existed with B? And it's just in this particular case, I had a mindset of what would be the thought process going through if Laurie Strode was the one in control. And I know I'm saying that a couple of times, but the truth is I was watching Halloween when I first saw this idea. So it's but the collection of it, like the themes that happen in the movie also come from just things that we all go through as teenagers and even as adults. And this movie's a coming of age romance the same way that it's a home invasion thriller. Like it's we're going after both sides here, and it's going after that raw emotion of teenage love that you have that time, as well as the absolutely real consequences of your actions, regardless how justified you are. I always have this kind of mindset where people have this tendency to act barbaric the moment they have a justification. I remember in my small town that I grew up in, there was this girl who got bullied a few years ago. I got caught on video. It was an awful situation, but it was caught on video, and suddenly you had all these grown adults across my town, several towns over, going all the way to Vancouver, making a big hype on the internet because it was the pandemic and most people weren't allowed to go outside often. So we're all really bored, and you know, everyone's looking for something to be fighting against. So suddenly you have all these grown adults being like, yeah, we're gonna have 3,000 cars at this car driving anti-bullying rally to show that we don't stand for bullying. And it's like, yeah, and you're trying to say how this girl should be tarred and feathered, this and that. And I guess in my mind I'm like, cool, but like, aren't you guys being just as bad at this point?
Yeah, right.
And that's kind of where my mindset comes in. So when you watch the movie, there's a constant question of, is what you're doing justified? Is what you're doing too far? You know what I mean? That's a constant thing throughout the film that I think plagues a lot of us in a lot of our decision-making process.
Also, as a filmmaker and a decision-making process as a filmmaker as well, because often when you're making films in the horror genre or even the action genre, or when you've got an ultra-violent thriller, how do you as a filmmaker decide what's too much?
Well, I'm not actually a torture porn fan. I'm not a fan of torture porn as a genre. I enjoy certain movies within certain series of that, but a number of critics have called this movie torture porn, and I guess there's a point where you can say that, but for me personally, I'm very much a classic horror fan. Like I'm very much thinking what you have in your head is far scarier than anything you can see in front of you, and I do believe that. You know, one of my favorite moments of restraint in a movie is 1963's The Haunting by Robert Wise. There's a scene in there where one of my favorites, and there's a scene in there where you have the two in there, and the room is dark, and you just have that moment where you're not really seeing anything because, you know, it was 1963. And what you hear is, you're holding my hand too hard. I'm not holding your hand. And it's just like, you don't need to see the hand. You don't need to see what's going on. But that alone sends chills right down the spine. You know full well what's going on. That's what works best to me. Our most violent moments in this movie are off screen. And I did that intentionally because for me, I want people to feel the tension, and I want them to feel the intensity of all, but I don't want them to feel turned away or turned off. And for me, what's considered too much is when you stop having a reason for things to happen.
Yeah.
When it's just, you know, you stop having a reason why people need to see this shot. You know, there's a movie like Hereditary, for instance, where I would argue it was very important to see her head after that electric post scene.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil too much of the movie, but I'm just like,
I think everybody,
I will say though,
everybody knows about that scene, right? People haven't seen the movie know about that scene.
You know, anybody who's listening to this show has at least probably seen that movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's a good example of where Ari Aster found an opportunity where he saw, no, you need to see this. You need, like, something about that visceral reaction was necessary. And it isn't always necessary, though. I mean, that's why that's why torture porn becomes torture porn, because you just start having excessive violence and gore without true purpose. It's why those first three Saw movies, I'll say, work quite well, because there's a story and purpose behind that.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they get a bit crazy after that,
I think. Then they get a bit crazy. Yeah, yeah.
I want to talk about your time on The Flash and how that really, what working on a show of that size and magnitude, because The Flash was just incredible. It ran for so long. It was really popular. It was loved and still is loved by so many fans. So first two-part question. The first part is, how was that for you working on a show of that size and scale? The second part to that question is, what did it teach you as a filmmaker?
Yeah, okay. So those are really good questions. I'll answer the first one first. So Working on a show of that scale. Sorry, your question was, what was it like working on a show of that scale? Was that the first question?
Yeah, what was it? And in general, what was it like working on The Flash?
Man, I got to tell you. So it even goes further than that. When I was a production assistant, when I was first starting off in film, I started working on Arrow season 2. So I have not left the Arrowverse for 10 years. I was a PA on Arrow seasons 2, 3, 4. I was video playback on The Flash seasons 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I also did Legends of Tomorrow season 4.
Nice.
So yeah, that was a fun one too. But you know, working on shows of this scale, it was crazy because I was trying to hone my own craft, hone my own skill. But you're in the mix of this thing that at the peak of it was a global phenomenon, you know, and it's hard not to recognize that. And I think a lot of that cultivated when we got to things like Crisis on Infinite Earths or Crisis on Earth X, when, you know, we're on set and I'm seeing certain things that people are not going to see for a while. Like when we shot the Grant Gustin, Ezra Miller scene.
Yeah.
With the two of them. And that was an extra NDA that we had to sign for the limited amount of people who are allowed to be on set, myself included. Like, we're talking, this was to the same scale as, like, you know, Samuel L. Jackson in the first Iron Man. Like, it was a skeleton crew. No one was allowed to talk about it. No one was allowed to say it. Grant Gustin got on the phone that day to stop Warner Brothers from doing a press release about it.
Oh, really?
That's why that one appeared out of nowhere on TV. But when you're doing these things to that scale, like, I've worked in a lot of television shows before, but the level of influence and what the importance that was being put on the storylines that were being done in that show was just of a whole other level. And being able to do my particular department on there was so much fun, because anytime you had somebody like Cisco, or later on, you had Chester.
Yeah.
By Brandon McKnight. And anytime you had one of them on the computers doing all like, oh my God, we got something going on downtown and The Flash, you got to go down there. You see all the computers start showing a map of everything. Like, that was all me doing that, right?
Nice.
That was all me creating all the, like, we were doing all the graphics on set. I'm running them on set with the actors, making sure that anytime they use a phone, TV, computer, anything with a screen, I'm in charge of all that, making sure that it looks like they're operating with it properly. We work with the actors. And I will say, now to transition to the second part of that question, the things I learned from working on a show like that have actually were completely invaluable. Like, when it came to a situation of having to constantly go up to these actors and talk to them and communicate with them about our props, about the playback stuff, you know, all that is learning communication. All of that is learning how to work with these sorts of people and people in these sorts of fields. And, you know, everything you're learning about how everything goes down right to the second. And if you're on a show like Flash, man, every single second counts when it comes to time, money, and schedule.
Yeah, for sure.
And so seeing all that from that perspective, and then not just that, but getting to work with directors who made things that I loved growing up. I remember one director we got to work with was John Badham. And if you're familiar with John Badham, he directed War Games, uh-huh, Short Circuit, and a little indie film called Saturday Night Fever. Yeah. I don't know if anyone's heard of it.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, man, like, you're sitting there talking to this guy and he's just like ripping out random stories about from the set of like Blue Thunder and stuff like that. And you're just listening to this guy talk about it. Like, you're hearing someone talk about, like, oh, you know, the other day at work, but his other day at work is things like Short Circuit and Blue Thunder. So when you have the opportunity to talk to these people, because a lot of these directors from the 70s and 80s who never really continued in the world of features transitioned to television around the late 80s, early 90s. So as a result, a lot of directors I've worked with were people who were making movies with like the best of them in the 80s and 90s and 70s. For God's sakes, working with Michael Schultz, no relation, working with Michael Schultz, he directed Yellow Submarine for the Beatles.
Kevin Smith. Or not Yellow Submarine, well.
He directed Sergeant Pepper. Sorry, Sergeant Pepper.
Kevin Smith as well.
I have worked with Kevin Smith 5 times, and I will go on the record of saying that Kevin Smith is one of the nicest and most approachable and one of the most genuine people in this entire industry. And I will say that with complete and total conviction.
Nice.
He is an absolute gem to work with. He is just a guy who seriously just loves movies, man. Like, there's no falsifying what his image is to people.
Yeah.
You know? Actually, there's a good story about that. We were on The Flash for the episode in season 4 with Null, I think it was. Season 3 or 4. But we were over at the Dick car setting up the scene. And Kevin is all of a sudden just at the Dick car too. And we've already set up the scene. And as soon as we set it up, he starts pulling out his phone. He's just watching random movie clips. And all of a sudden, it's like there's 5 or 6 of us who are standing around him as he's giving us this sudden lecture on this one scene in Return of the Jedi with the Sarlacc pit. And he's just like, he's going on this 15-minute tangent about the scene. And he's just like, then he plays the scene. And I had to walk away and I had to walk and do some other stuff because, you know, we're all being paid to do a job too. So I gotta go pay and do that. I'm on the other side of the damn soundstage. And it's the moment where Luke Skywalker jumps off the plank and R2-D2 shoots his lightsaber up and he grabs it. And that scene, you hear Kevin from the other side of the stage, just like from across the whole soundstage, being like, all right. Ah, magic of the fucking movies, man! Like, yelling it out so loudly. And it's like that. He created such a fun environment, though, to work with. And I got to actually be able to thank him a long time later because our movie ended up getting nominated for 3 awards at his first film festival, the Smog Castle Film Fest. We got nominated for Best Drama Feature, Best Lead Actress, and Best Editing.
That's so amazing.
At the festival, I was able to talk to him and just kind of thank him for a lot of that because I credit Kevin Smith with a lot of inspiration of how I knew I could go forward with this job in my life, you know?
Yeah, he's awesome. He is an inspiration. I mean, I've not had the opportunity to talk to him yet. He's definitely on my list of people I really want to do a podcast with, but 100% he is an inspiration, not just for me, but for many, I think. So, yeah.
Prepare for a 4-hour episode if you do, by the way.
I love it. No, he can have the day, man. He can have the day. So, let's just coming back around to your movie, Girl Gone Bad. How can we see the film here in the UK and where can we find out more?
In the UK, Girl Gone Bad is currently for rent or purchase on Amazon, and it will soon be streaming on Amazon in a couple months as well at, for free, as well as with Tubi. It will be on as well. If you're listening to this for whatever reason in the US and Canada, US is Amazon.com rental. Canada is currently on Google Videos. As I mentioned earlier, they will all be on proper Amazon streaming in due time.
Girl Gone Bad. That's available right now. I do recommend you go and check that out. Congratulations on the release of your film. I know how excited you've been about this. I'm very excited to see where this goes for you next. What are your plans after this? Now the movie's out, what happens next for you?
All right. So our producer Giovanna and I are currently working on potentially producing my next feature right now. It is a exorcism horror comedy that I wrote in the pre-production with my partner, Kayla Howard, who's both my partner in life and currently in writing. We wrote this script together. It's an exorcism horror comedy, absolutely hysterical. I've been trying to get it off the ground. And Giovanna, our producer, and I right now are working towards doing exactly that, for which currently working on a script that could be compared, that's very Death Wish and Taken influenced. Hoping nice. To do that afterwards. And yeah, I don't know, man. Still working and writing. And now that we have corporate greed not allowing people to get paid properly for their work, which has put them in a position where they have to no longer do the work. I refuse to say that the strikes are the fault. But now that we're in that situation, we're just trying to take the time and see what we can do.
Of course.
In the meantime, I have a podcast, Martini Window.
Martini Window. Check that out as well on all podcast platforms, I guess.
Yeah, currently it is on Spotify, Deezer, and Apple Music, and Amazon Music.
Check that out right now. Kevin, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with the movie and wishing you all the very best, my friend.
Thank you very much, John.
Kevin Schultz there, the director of Girl Gone Bad. You can check that. He's brilliant. I love him so much. You can get that now on Amazon Prime, and it's just debuted in the US as well. So it's here in the UK and the US, and I think some other countries as well. Do check it out. Thank you to Kevin Schultz. Oh, we've torn through this one, haven't we?
Yes, absolutely. Fantastic.
He's so impressed, because normally he's like, he looks at me, stares across the room, he's like, running out of time, running out of time, running out of time. He doesn't say it, but he just gives me a look. He has a running out of time look. He's giving it to me now. So come on, let's go.
It's time for our tip top five.
Okay, yes. So I set up, I literally before we walked in, I went, hey, let's do dogs. And he went, yeah, perfect. Not Don't look at me like that. Let's have dogs in our tip top five.
And you're going to edit that, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. It suddenly reminds me of a Blink 182 song. Anyway, so, well, that makes it even funnier because it wasn't there in the first place. That's why he's laughing, because I've done him. Oh, we did it again. Right, okay. The tip top five for this week is about dogs. Thank you so much to everybody that wrote in. I set up campaign for a better word, and we made some nice imaging and we put the everything out there in the world, because Paul was on air at the time when it happened. So I thank you to anyone who responded to any of the posts that I put out for you. Thank you so much to Paul for trusting me to not cock that up. Lamppost? No? Okay.
No, I got it. Yeah, I got it.
Woof, woof. So, everybody's ready. Thank you so much to those of you that sent yours in, Paul has got his ready. Mine isn't ready because I was too busy asking all of you for all of yours.
Well,
can
we do the listeners first? Because the listeners understood the assignment and I didn't.
Okay, let's go.
Right, so here are our listeners.
No, we need a jingle here. Ready?
The We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod Listener's Choices.
That's you, that is.
Oh, look at that. I never sounded so good.
Thank you very much, Simon Bruce. He made that for us. Thank you, sir.
So, our listeners' suggestions for their top five movies about dogs. Julia Minty says, cannot be doing with sad ending to dog films, so it has got to be Scooby-Doo, Clifford, Snow Dogs, Secret Life of Pets, and A Dog's Purpose. I haven't seen that one. Don't know that one, A Dog's Purpose. Okay.
Yeah, happy with those. Thank you.
Wayne Johnston said, tricky. And followed it up with, number one, Up. He says, am I allowed this? Absolutely, you're allowed this.
If it's got a dog in it, it's fair game.
Turner and Hooch, The Fox and the Hound, which I remember from my youth. Absolutely. Homeward Bound, and then tops it all off was Cujo.
What a diverse selection.
I know,
selection.
Right? All those lovely, lovely films about dogs, and then finishes it off with Cujo.
Simon Bruce has sent his in. Have you still got some more there? Actually, no, read those out. Let's go.
James Secker has said Man's Best Friend, Love of Monsters, which is great, by the way, Cujo, Homeward Bound, and Air Bud Spikes Back. I don't know that one, James. And then very finally, Josh Knight says The Incredible Journey, Homeward Bound, Homeward Bound 2, Lost in San Francisco. What an awful name. The Adventures of Milo and Otis, and Sea Spot Run.
Simon Bruce, who made our jingle. Thank you, sir.
We're going to need a bigger pod. Tip top five.
There we go. Thanks, Simon Bruce. He also sent a top five. Top five dog films in no particular order. The Wrong Trousers, Incredible Journey. Incredible Journey, 1963. Call of the Wild, 1972. Isle of Dogs, 2018. And John Wick, 2014. There were any John Wick movies, because there's a dog in all of them. But I'm going to say John Wick, the first one. And probably by far and away the best day in that. John Wick Chapter 4 was pretty spectacular. Thank you, Simon Bruce, for that. He says, if you don't count the last one, you are heartless. It's the whole premise for the series. That's very true. Literally everything that happens in the John Wick series is because of that first moment. I think we got everyone. If we didn't, for any reason, we will circle back around to it next week. Thank you for those. Okay.
So my five, I'd misunderstood the assignment and just went for like cool dogs in a film rather than films about a dog.
It's all relevant.
I just wanted to say John Wick 4 just dropped out of my top five.
Oh, interesting.
Because the dog in John Wick 4 I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
But it just dropped out of my top five. In no particular order, I Am Legend.
Mm-hmm.
Scooby-Doo, because Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
The Mask.
Oh, yeah.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And finally, arguably the best dog in any film ever made, Mitchell's versus the Machines.
Oh, excellent.
Monchi.
Excellent. Yeah.
Dog, pig, loaf of bread.
Yeah, I think, what a film that is.
It's brilliant.
What a film that is. I'm just going to pick five I really like. Mitchell versus the Machines is definitely up there, though. That's a good shout. Really good shout. I'm pinching that, definitely. I think, for me, it kind of harks back to, like, childhood as well. Like, K-9, Tanner and Hooch.
Yeah.
K-9 and Tanner and Hooch. Although Tanner and Hooch I can't watch because he dribbles a lot, and the dribbling just absolutely, like, gags me out. But what a great movie. Yeah.
Yes.
K-9 with Jim Belushi as
well. Yeah, brilliant.
Tanner and Hooch, love that. I'm going to say, I think Scooby-Doo's got to be in there by default, hasn't he?
The official Scooby-Doo movie or cartoon? Because I love the official Scooby-Doo movie.
Yeah, James Gunn wrote that, didn't he? I think.
I don't know. Yeah, I think he did write it. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, and also, yeah, we mentioned Mitchell's versus the Machines. I'm going to throw the John Wick saga in there.
The whole John Wick saga.
John Wick features some magnificent dogs throughout the course of those four movies.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say the John Wick saga. But if we have to choose one and we're being really pedantic, then obviously, do you know why? John Wick 3, though? Because Halle Berry's dogs in John Wick 3.
Do you know why I didn't go for the original puppy in John Wick 1? Is because it barely gets any screen time. I know it's literally the premises for the entire franchise.
Yeah.
But it's got very limited screen time.
Yeah, I think Halle Berry's Dogs in.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In three. If I've got to pick one movie. There we go. Those are five that I just really like. I've got to be honest with you. I just really liked them. So, yeah, that's my top five that if I was going to watch a dog movie, I'd probably go for that. And again, movies generally, where especially if you watch Chapter 3, movies generally, I think literally every dog movie I just chose, none of them die. Again, if you're catching John Wick. Julia, you're right. Julia Minty's absolutely right. Let's have dog movies where they don't pass away.
Marley and Me, I've seen it. I don't know how many times I've seen it. And it doesn't matter how many times I watch it. I cannot watch that movie without literally crying my eyes out.
It's stunning,
like,
but it's...
Like snot bubbles and everything.
Yeah, it's stunning, but it's tragic.
Devastating. Absolutely
so tragic.
Devastating.
It's probably one of the greatest dog movies ever made, without a shadow of a doubt. Do you know what? And I thought Dog was great as well. I'm not going to put it in the top five, but
it was
pretty good.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it was good.
Channing Tatum, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go check that out. It's on Amazon Prime. Go.
Okay.
That's your home.
Go now.
Okay.
See you later.
Thank you very much. We have got lots coming up next week. In fact, we've got so much. We've done so much in the last week that we couldn't tell you which we're going to play next week, which we're not, because we don't know what.
Just stay tuned. Honestly, just stay tuned to our socials. Stay tuned to our channels.
Yep. At Need a Bigger Pod. At Express FM, at John Brown TV, at Paul Swampy Marsh. Do follow us, but not in a stalkerish way, because that's weird and it's Halloween, so you'll make us even more scared. Thank you very much to The View Cinema and Gunwolf Keys for making sure we watch everything every week. MyView.com to find your nearest view. And thank you very much to Express FM Studios, who for some reason still tolerate this nonsense. Thank you to you, Paul.
Thank you to you, John.
And we're done. Now, about spoiling everything.
Yeah, I know.
When we need to have the conversation, because at the end of the day, like, you just can't do that. Some people haven't seen anything.
Yeah, but mate,
you know, some people haven't seen films from 30 years ago.
It's Paw Patrol.
Look at you. You haven't seen... Yeah, but you haven't... You know,